It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Here in Wisconsin, we love to talk about the weather, but there's a citizen science project where people do a lot more than talk. They take measurements and observations that help shape our understanding of the weather. There are lots of observers for the Community Collaborative Rain, Hail, and Snow Network around the country. Observers collect precipitation data in their communities to help improve the accuracy of forecasts. That network is currently looking for volunteers here in Wisconsin to help them out. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a weather fan? Have you worked with this project or been trained maybe as a weather spotter? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Sarah Marquardt is a senior service hydrologist and meteorologist for the National Weather Service based in Milwaukee and Sullivan. Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Can you tell us a little bit about how this Community Collaborative Rain, Hail, and Snow Network works?
So it's a very simple process. We're looking for volunteers who purchase a rain gauge or put out a board to measure snowfall. And you take your measurement every morning between 7 and 9 in the morning, and you submit that online. It then goes to an archive, a database online, where everyone can view that data. And you can track how much rain or snow fell right in your own backyard. So it's a very simple process, but it's very valuable data for us at the National Weather Service.
One thing that leaps to mind, if I do this, does it mean I have to be there every single morning, or do I get to go on vacation still?
Yes, yes, you can take a break. We're happy to take as much data as we can get, but certainly we understand that you can't take observations every day. So if you're gone for a few days, you can still submit your report. It's called a multi-day accumulation. You just submit how much rain is in that rainfall gauge over the several days that you were gone, and you can still submit that data. And we just ask that you take measurements as much as possible, whatever is reasonable for you.
And now, how much does this help you as a meteorologist and your colleagues when people are collecting this kind of data from lots of points around the state?
This data is so important. I look at this data every day. So my job is to assess flood risk and drought conditions, and I need to know how much rain fell across the entire state of Wisconsin, and that can vary from location to location. So by having these rainfall reports, I can tell exactly what fell in which areas, who has received more rain, so who's more susceptible to flood risk, or who hasn't seen much rain. Where has it not rained at all for several days and drought may be developing? So every location matters. Every report matters. This is data that it's really important to get exactly observed measurements of what happened on the ground.
Are there parts of the state where you see particularly big gaps where you're really hoping more people will step up and volunteer?
Yeah, we are hoping to fill a lot of gaps across northern and central Wisconsin. We do have quite a few observers in the cities, of course, where there's more of a population center, but we are hoping to fill gaps across every corner of the state. So we'd like to have a representative from every community, an observer in every town, every city across the state.
Sarah Marquardt is with us, senior service hydrologist and meteorologist at the National Weather Service based in Milwaukee, Sullivan, looking at a citizen science project where people, as you just heard, collect rain and snow data and share it for better forecasts in the future. Sarah, if somebody wants to get involved, where does one buy the rain gauge? How do we make sure we have the right kind that's going to give us the best measurements?
To find out more information, you can go to the website, cocorahs.org, to find more information, or you can get in touch with your local National Weather Service forecast office, and we can answer your questions and point you in the right direction. All you need to do is purchase an official rain gauge, or if that's not an option, just get a piece of plywood, put that out to measure snowfall, and you can get started. There's training available online. There's some slideshows that tell you everything you need to know to become an observer. But any of us at the National Weather Service are happy to answer any questions and help you get started.
Something I wonder about with things like rain and snowfall, Sarah, is, you know, I can get the gist when I look at the weather forecast. Rain is likely to hit this area, this county where I live. As you look at this data, especially where you have lots of people collecting it, do you see a lot of micro variation where this side of a town gets a ton of rain, that side gets a few drops?
Yes, that happens all the time, and that's why this data is so important. In the summer, thunderstorms pop up in different areas, and some areas can get heavy rain, and other areas just a few miles down the road get nothing. So that's why having a denser network of these observations is so important. And also for tracking drought, some areas just keep missing out on the rain. We had a drought all last year, and going into this year, parts of western Wisconsin have seen very little rain. So watching those areas that are reporting zero rainfall day after day, that's exactly the kind of data we're looking for. And every little piece helps, and getting that denser network really helps us get a better idea, paint a better picture of what's happening on the ground.
You mentioned a lot of your work involves floods and the risk of floods. Can you talk about how you use this and obviously other data as well to try to predict who might be susceptible to floods, maybe where floods might happen where we didn't think of them as flooding areas in the past?
Yeah, so not only is flooding a concern in the summer, it's also a concern in the winter and spring. And part of this network, people can also submit snow core observations, which tells us how much water is in that snowpack. And we watch that during the late winter and early spring to see where is there more water. Those areas may be more susceptible to flooding as that snow melts. And also just watching over time which areas are under those heavy rainstorms. What neighborhoods are getting more rain than other neighborhoods that may be more susceptible to flooding if those rains continue? There's even an option for observers to submit reports during a rainstorm. And if you submit that report, it's called a significant weather report. That information will alert directly on the screens of the National Weather Service forecasters. And you can tell us exactly how much rain is falling as it's happening. And we may then be able to get a flash flood warning out sooner, alert people to seek higher ground sooner based on that report by telling us exactly how much rain is occurring and what's happening in your area. So it's we are working together to get the information and share the information and keep the public safe.
Are there other ways you could see the public helping with weather forecasting and reporting? I know my folks for a while were trained as storm spotters, tornado spotters in Michigan. Are there other kind of public citizen science things that people can do to help off the meteorologists?
Yes, during the spring, we do a program training people how to become severe storm spotters. So that training is offered by the National Weather Service, teaches you everything you need to know about how to spot storms, how to stay safe during storms, and how to get that information to the forecasters so that we can have a better idea of what's going on and create a better forecast. There are several other networks out there to monitor drought conditions through the National Drought Mitigation Center. They have a network where you can document how wet or dry conditions are in your area to help keep the drought monitor more accurate. And similar thing can be done with the Kokoroz network, where you can note how wet or dry conditions are, what are the fields looking like in your area, how are the retention ponds, are they getting full, are they running dry? Just monitoring the conditions and getting that information to other scientists and meteorologists out there so we can better assess the conditions.
And Sarah, as we wrap up, you mentioned that Kokoroz Network, short for Community Collaborative Rain, Hail, and Snow Network. How do people get involved if they want to join in and help out?
It's very easy to get involved. You just go to that website, cokoroz.org, and fill out a short form to sign up. Say where you live so we can have an idea of where that rainfall report is coming from. And once you sign up, it is up to you to purchase that rain gauge. Once you have that rain gauge, you put it outside in a flat area of your yard. You can start submitting reports. You'll get access to an online form where you just type in how much rain or snow fell each morning. And easy as that, you type in that information and it gets updated to the website, to the database. You have a nice archive where you can look back and see, track all of your data every day, all the measurements that fell from your own backyard. So it's very easy. It only takes a minute a day to go out there, check your rain gauge, stick a ruler in the ground, measure the snow depth, and then submit that data for everyone to have access to.
Sarah, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That's Sarah Marquardt, senior service hydrologist and meteorologist for the National Weather Service based in Milwaukee, Sullivan. She talked to us about the Community Collaborative Rain, Hail, and Snow Network. We'll get a link, by the way, to their site up at WPR.org/Central Time. Next up, we'll hear from a Wisconsin astrophotographer about the upcoming solar eclipse. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if you are going to be traveling to see the solar eclipse in not too long now. Let us know about it, 800-642-1234, or maybe share your 2017 full solar eclipse memories. We'll pick up that conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. A total solar eclipse is coming up in just over a week on Monday, April 8th. It's the second total solar eclipse to come to the United States in just 7 years. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Love to hear from you if you're making plans to travel south, which you'll need to do to see the full experience. That's 800-642-1234, or if you've ever seen a total solar eclipse. Caitlin Moore joins us, Director of Communications for the UW-Madison Department of English and acclaimed amateur astrophotographer. Caitlin's work has been featured in Live Science, Space.com, and the Overture Center for the Arts, and it's on permanent display at several laboratories across the UW. Caitlin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
I'm delighted to be here.
Remind us what a solar eclipse is.
So a solar eclipse, in short, is actually quite simple in terms of its mechanics, but its actual occurrence is very, very rare. It's when the moon passes between the Earth and the sun, and the eclipse occurs when the moon's shadow is cast onto the surface of the Earth.
And how common are these? A lot of them might happen, and we don't get to see them here in the U.S. How common are these around the world?
They are, I would say, once or twice a year in terms of the commonality on a yearly basis, but as occurring over populated areas, they're very, very rare. Because the moon is actually at a 5-degree tilt off the axis of Earth's rotation around the sun, there isn't a perfect plane alignment between the moon and the sun, so it doesn't occur quite as often as we would think it would, because the mechanics of it are ostensibly pretty simple.
And we've gotten two just 7 years apart hitting the United States. Now, we haven't gotten either of them, the full one here in Wisconsin. Is it common for the same place to get a couple shots at it in such a relatively short period of time?
No, we've been very, very lucky. And the one this year is going to be even more spectacular than the one in 2017 for a couple of reasons, not least of which because the sun is actually entering what's known as its solar maximum period, whereas back in 2017, it was entering its solar minimum period.
Now, let's get into your experience with the eclipse. First of all, I understood you are planning to journey south to see it. Do I have that right?
Yes.
And where are you going to go? What kind of plans are you making? It sounds like I'm not going myself, which is good, because if I went, there'd be a lot of cloud cover. talk about your plans for catching the eclipse.
Well, you sort of hit the nail on the head. It's finding a balance between being within the path of totality and trying to take into account, all right, what is the weather going to do on a particular day? So your best bet for traveling to see the solar eclipse is to look at sort of the weather tables for particular locations, look at where it has the likeliest possibility of having a clear sky. And that's places like northern Mexico and Texas. The further north you go in through Ohio, the areas around the Great Lakes into upstate New York, you have a higher chance of hitting sort of cloudy and overcast skies.
Talking to Caitlin Moore, well-known amateur astrophotographer based here in Wisconsin, about the solar eclipse. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Caitlin, astrophotography. You're not just pulling your phone out of your pocket and taking pictures. I know that doesn't work very well. What goes into astrophotography?
Yes. So I use a 600mm zoom lens on a Nikon DSLR camera. It's a combination of finding a good camera, a good lens, and having a tripod to keep everything steady. And of course, when one sets up for photographing a solar eclipse, there's a couple extra sort of safety precautions one has to take.
Like what? I mean, I know we got to wear the glasses if we're looking at it with the naked eye. Yeah, I assume it doesn't work to just look through your camera lens.
No, that's a really important thing, particularly people who are using telescopes or binoculars. It's not enough to wear those special glasses and then look through the binoculars and then look through the telescope. You could still damage your eyes. There are particular filters that one has to purchase that fit on the end of the lens, so the lens where the light hits first. And these specialized lenses can filter out up to 100,000 times the light, the visible and ultraviolet spectrum of the sun. This prevents not only your eyes getting damaged, but also the equipment that you're using.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Carolyn is with us in Madison. Carolyn, hi.
Hi. Hello. It was not cloudy here in Madison. I am going to take a white cardboard out under trees. It's amazing how many pinholes are in different kinds of trees. All we got is evergreens right now to try this out under. But the last time there was an eclipse, I discovered all the crescents on the ground and brought out a white cardboard just to catch. Oh, look at those. Look at that one. It was different under any tree we went under.
And Carolyn, you did that here in Wisconsin, so we got kind of a partial view.
It was a while back.
Yeah, 7 years ago, I think. Yeah. Carolyn, I remember that. I was down on the landing here at our building. It was weird and eerie, not as cool as the full thing. Caitlin, can you talk about the weird optical thing that Carolyn was talking about, those crescents appearing?
Certainly, and those are really, really cool. And there's actually a good chance of that happening again this year, because the percentage totality that this area of Wisconsin is going to experience is around about high 80s to low 90% of totality. So when you look at those shadows that are cast, they're going to appear as those crescents, mostly because that's how much of the sun is actually casting the shadow at that point.
Thanks a lot for that call, Carol. Now, once again, I'm not going to go see the whole thing. When that last one came around, I talked to a guest who said something like, the difference between the full and the partial is like, you know, seeing the Super Bowl during the game and visiting the stadium the next morning, right? It's a pretty big difference.
Yes. The thing that's really remarkable about a full solar eclipse is that it's night in microcosm. Crickets will start to chirp. You'll see the stars in the sky. Birds will go quiet. Your pets might behave a bit strangely.
Interesting. Now, have you gone and tried to photograph an eclipse before, Caitlin?
I have tried to photograph that. We actually had what's known as an annular solar eclipse back in October of 2023 and had plans to take images of it here in Wisconsin. Unfortunately, it was cloudy and rainy the entire day and it didn't work out. When the 2017 full solar eclipse happened, I was actually in the wrong hemisphere. Down in New Zealand at the time. So been in touch with my other astrophotography mates, my other astronomers, and the plan this year, because we are getting a full path of totality through a really sizable portion of the United States that has high population density, the plan is this year is to get it.
Let's go back to our callers. Donna is with us in Bayfield County. Donna, hi.
Hi. I'm curious about what it will be like. I'm going to be flying from California to back to Wisconsin on the 8th. And I'll be leaving early morning from California and returning here like mid-afternoon. So I'm just curious about what I might observe.
Oh, interesting. Caitlin, any thoughts on what Donna might see along the way from the sky?
Oh, that's a great question. There's actually been a number of flights that are scheduled to depart from the Dallas-Fort Worth area that are specifically for viewing the solar eclipse. So based on the flight path that you're going to be taking, you're not going to be passing within the path of totality. But depending on what side of the plane you're seated, if you look out the window, and of course you want to make sure you're wearing eye protection, you're not looking directly at the sun, you could actually see some of that partial path of totality, particularly sort of towards midday and into early afternoon.
Thanks for that call, Donna. Good luck. I hope you see cool stuff there. Caitlin, I understand a lot of scientists, astronomers try to take advantage of an eclipse to see stuff in the sky.
Yes.
What kind of opportunities does this open up for us apart from, you know, just the eclipse itself?
Well, one of the really interesting things that's happening right now is that we're actually getting a periodic comet passing close by Earth. It's Comet 12P Pons-Brooks. It is about a couple degrees higher than the sun in the sky. Of course, you can't regularly see this comet when the sun is out. But in the path of totality, I said it's sort of a microcosm of the night sky, the stars come out, it can be dark enough to actually see this comet. So when the sun isn't visible, you're able to take measurements, you're able to actually do observational astronomical work in the daytime. A very famous example of this is Sir Arthur Eddington, the mathematician, actually proved Einstein's theory of relativity during a solar eclipse because they were able to take measurements of the way light was bent.
Time for one more caller. Dean is with us on the road in Wisconsin. Dean, hi.
Hi. I actually live in Nashville, and I saw the last one. And I plan on going up for the next one as well next week. And it really is beyond words how to describe it other than the most glorious diamond that you've ever seen. I like to tell people there are some things you just can't, see on TV or a picture of, like the Grand Canyon, and you got to go see it. Or otherwise, it's just a big hole in a picture. And it's the same thing for the total eclipse. When you see it in person, I cried a little bit. It's just so amazingly beautiful.
Wow. Dean, thanks a lot for sharing this. Caitlin, in our last few moments, this can be kind of an overwhelming thing to see, it sounds like.
Oh, yeah. And Dean sort of hit the nail on the head. It's like what Jodie Foster says, they should have sent a poet. But what's going to be really even more extraordinary this year, because as I said, the sun is entering its period of solar maximum, which means its coronal activity is going to be very, very active. So during the totality, when the sun is completely covered, you'll be able to see the outer atmosphere of the sun, what's known as the corona. It's this beautiful, hazy, sort of pearlescent white that surrounds the dark disk of the moon. It's going to be absolutely extraordinary.
Caitlin, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Of course.
Caitlin Moore is Director of Communications for the UW-Madison English Department and an acclaimed astrophotographer. We've been talking about the upcoming total solar eclipse. Hey, if you go and you get good pictures, be careful, take them just right, but then send them along to us. Email ideas@WPR.org when you got them. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. It's Food Friday. Today, we're exploring the wide world of brunch. For a lot of people, Easter Sunday will be an opportunity to gather around the table with friends and family for the popular late morning to early afternoon meal. We're not far away from Mother's Day and another chance to serve up an awesome brunch. You don't even need a holiday to enjoy it. Our next guest is here to help us put together a well-balanced and delicious menu for any brunchly occasion. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What separates a good brunch from a great one? Do you have a go-to dish or recipe? And hey, do you prefer making it at home or going out to a restaurant brunch? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Aaron Clark is the Milwaukee-based creator of the recipe website WellPlated.com and the author of The Well-Plated Cookbook, Fast, Healthy Recipes You'll Want to Eat, and the forthcoming Well-Plated Every Day. Aaron, welcome back to Central Time.
So happy to be here.
Now, some people, I think brunch is like, yeah, okay, it's another meal. Some people are excited. Where do you fall on the brunch spectrum, Aaron?
I'm hard-pressed to find someone that really deep down doesn't love brunch. It's just the ultimate anything-goes meal. Do you want sweet? Do you want savory? Do you want to have an adult beverage with that? If you're in Wisconsin, it's definitely okay. Like, brunch, all the rules are off, and I think it's just such a fun way to kick back and relax with friends and family.
Now, there are a lot of brunch basics and standbys and things like that. If somebody's like, yeah, I make a lot of brunches, I need something to, something new and different, what kind of things do you suggest to zest it up a little bit?
Well, sometimes I think it's fun, like if you have something in like a recipe that typically would lean one direction and then take it another direction. So for example, we think French toast casserole. What do you think? You think sweet, you think maple syrup. Well, I think it's really fun you could to do kind of a savory twist on that. You can still do, you know, the bread with the custard, but try adding some cheese, prosciutto, sauteed spinach, a sausage. Like it's kind of the same spirit, but then it turns it into the savory side. So that's a really nice way to mix it up.
And a brunch tends to be, you know, there's not like just one thing or one thing and a side dish. It seems like brunch is all about the variety. How do you start? And you've done this on your website, wellplated.com. How do you start putting together a brunch menu, a brunch spread?
I mean, I feel like if you only have one or two things, then it's not actually brunch.
Right.
It's still breakfast. And we want it to be solidly in the brunch category. So whenever I'm planning a brunch menu or honestly any menu, the first thing I like to start with is what is going to be in my oven and when does it need to come out? Because the situation you don't want to be in is you've got, you know, your egg bake in the oven, you make your muffins. Now suddenly the muffins are ready to go in the oven, but wait, they're at a different temperature. The egg bake is still in there. So I kind of like to think, you know, I like to have one kind of hearty, savory dish that anchors it. And for that, I do love some kind of egg bake. And then I sort of build everything else around that. So it's nice to have a sweet option. You know, you can make something like muffins. You can pick up cinnamon rolls at your local bakery. Like, don't feel like you have to make everything from scratch. You can outsource to friends that are coming over. For a little bit of balance, I think it's always nice to have something healthy or healthy-ish, like a fruit salad is perfect. If you think that is a little too boring on its own, you could set out some vanilla yogurt and some granola next to it that people could top off. And then whenever possible, I like to do at least one main thing the night before. And that is why overnight casseroles are so perfect for brunch. You know, you can assemble it the night before. And then as much as I love having brunch and entertaining for brunch, I don't actually want to cook that much when I wake up. So the more you can get done the day before, the better.
It's Food Friday. Erin Clark is with us, Wisconsin's own Erin Clark, creator of the website wellplated.com and books in the Well Plated family. We're talking about brunch, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Is there a dish that must be there to count it as a brunch? What is your favorite thing to make and or eat for brunch? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Erin, you foreshadowed some of the recipes you shared with us. You mentioned overnight stuff you've shared with us. We'll get to have this up at WPR.org/food. And overnight French toast. Talk us through how this overnight concept works for our French toast.
Definitely. So I love French toast. I do not love standing at the stove to flip French toast one at a time. Like that's just a little too precious for an average morning. And maybe, you know, if you're just a household of one or two, that's pretty quick and easy. But when you're doing French toast for a crowd, the last thing you want to do is be strapped to your oven. So essentially, you take the French toast components, the bread, your nice egg custard. I always like to add a lot of vanilla extract and cinnamon to mine just for a little something something. And then you can tear the bread into cubes. That's kind of the classic French toast casserole preparation. But something else I really love to do is to leave the slices whole. And then this is a little hard to picture, but you can see a photo of it on my website. You can actually arrange the bread slices sort of like fallen dominoes or in different patterns, and it results in that French toast classic taste, but it gives you this wow presentation factor that just makes something that is, you know, everyone likes it, French toast casserole, but that and maybe it doesn't feel special enough for, say, Easter. It really gives it that kind of extra wow factor. And depending on how you like your French toast casserole, you can bake it until, you know, it is still like pretty soft inside, or you can keep going until you get more of that crispy top with like a bread pudding like middle. It's just delicious.
And this is one where most of the work happens the night before and we're just pretty much reheating it for serving on the actual brunch occasion.
Yeah, great. Yes, great point. So what I liked, you can do that, but when reheated, French toast can kind of dry out a little bit. So what I like to do is I prep everything all the way up until the point that it's about to go in the oven. You throw some saran wrap over the top and you just put that baby in the refrigerator and tell it goodnight. Then the next morning, you know, probably about an hour before you're wanting to serve, pull it out of the refrigerator and let it come to room temperature while your oven preheats. That way you're not putting a super cold pan in a hot oven. And then from there, like, all the work is done for you. It's kind of like someone showed up to cook you breakfast, except that person is you from the night before.
Well, and I could see that being really good and functional, because one problem I have with bread pudding or French toast is if I'm in a hurry, the custard doesn't soak in all the way to the bread. So you might have those dry spots in the middle. Sitting in the fridge overnight, I imagine everything gets good and soaked, right?
Oh, totally. Like, the slices kind of meld together, and it really is almost like a bread pudding. It's so, so tasty. And then I love that you can use, you know, you can use day old bread if you happen to have it around, or if, you know, you don't have day old bread, something that I will do is just pop it into the oven to toast the bread a little bit. That dries it out and it makes it better able to absorb the custard.
Now, you also have by the way, at WPR.org/food, you've got some egg action for us here. A quiche. Now, this quiche is one of my standbys for a brunch, because that's one where you could totally make it in advance, just heat it up in the morning. You've got an easy quiche for us, which I like the sound of. Tell us what makes this one easy.
So I discovered this wonderful hack where the thing that is easier to do actually ends up tasting better, and I have never gone back. So this quiche has a few shortcuts in it, or as my mom would like to say, none of your business. But one of the quick things that I love to do is I always recommend grating your own cheese instead of getting it pre-shredded in the bag, because the pre-shredded kind of has a white coating on it that's meant to prevent it from clumping, but it really just doesn't give you that same wonderful creamy melt that we want in our quiche and that we, as Wisconsinites, appreciate in our cheese. So what I do instead is I actually dice the cheese, and then you get these little melty pockets in it all throughout. It's quicker than doing it on a box grater, and I think the result is even better. Other super easy things you can do with quiche is if you just start with stuff that's already cooked and takes no prep, like, you know, a block of cheese, it takes nothing other than dicing it. You can get some great ham from your deli that's already cooked, toss that right in. And then where you can really save a lot of time is if you opt for a store-bought pie crust. You know, if quiche is the only thing that you're making for an entire meal, like, there's nothing quite like homemade pie crust, but when you're trying to do a quiche and a French toast bake and a fruit salad and you want to make some Bloody Marys, like, it just all really adds up. So that's where store-bought pie crust can come in. And by the time it has all of those quiche goodies on the inside, it really is still quite tasty and can save you a lot of hassle.
And I'm all for using that pre-made crust. I used to make quiche, and I'd make like just a pat in the pan crust. Even that's still kind of a pain. And I used to think, oh, quiche, that's a big deal. It's a big production. Starting with the pre-made crust, I was like, every time I make it, I was like, that's so easy. Like, why do I think it's a big deal anymore? No shame in those time savers, Aaron, it sounds like.
Not at all. I mean, after all, this is brunch. It's supposed to be relaxing.
It's Food Friday. We're talking to Aaron Clark, creator of the recipe website, wellplated.com. Talk about how to make a great brunch, a better brunch, maybe. A couple recipes that Aaron has shared. We have them up at WPR.org/food. Now, we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you have any secrets to a great brunch? Is there a family recipe or staple food for your holiday brunches? Do you like to have brunch anytime that you have the time? Are you anti-brunch? Are there people out there like that? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. It's Food Friday. We're picking up our talk with Aaron Clark, creator of the recipe website, wellplated.com, author of books including The Well-Plated Cookbook, Fast, Healthy Recipes You'll Want to Eat. She's with us today to share recipes and tips for brunch, whether you're hosting an Easter meal, planning ahead for Mother's Day, or just enjoying the hybrid breakfast-lunch meal any day of the week. Any brunch fans out there in Wisconsin? I guess not, but if there are, you could join in at 800-642-1234. What food or foods or combination says brunch to you? Do you like to have it at home, at somebody else's home, or at a restaurant? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Aaron, we've got a lively conversation going on our behind-the-scenes Slack channel here. Producers love brunch. Rochelle says she has a sweet versus savory conundrum with brunch. She'll usually do savory for the main dish or the sweet side, like a single pancake or a sweet beverage. Sarah Hopeful, our technical director, loves pancakes for the table at home or at a restaurant. How do you juggle savory and sweet, Erin, in your brunch lineup?
I am a massive fan of the pancakes for the table, especially when we go out, because I don't necessarily want a whole stack of pancakes or French toast for my full meal, but I just need that something with maple syrup in it. Like, if it's a brunch and I haven't had some maple syrup, like, my life is just going to feel a little bit less complete. So I love that. I think that's awesome.
Now, another recipe you've shared with us is for deviled eggs. I love deviled eggs, but hold on. Why are they green in the middle? There's avocado. Tell us about these avocado deviled eggs, Erin.
Okay, go with it. The avocado makes the filling so especially creamy, and then you add a little bit of lemon juice to liven it up. They are absolutely fantastic. My family is proud deviled egg connoisseurs. We have them every single Easter, and we've switched up. We've tried all different kinds of flavors and twists over the years, and the avocado is really everyone's favorite. If you want, you can keep it vegetarian, and it is also very good with a piece of thick, crispy bacon. Just you kind of chop those pieces up and then garnish the eggs with it. It's super yummy.
Let's bring out a caller at 800-642-1234. Stephanie is with us in Beaver Dam. Stephanie, hi.
Good afternoon.
What do you want to tell us about your brunch habits, Stephanie?
So when I'm doing brunch at home, I love quiche. And my favorite quiche to make is like the cream cheese and bagels, or those, you know, the lox. Mm-hmm. With the smoked salmon and cream cheese, capers. It's just, it's beautiful. It bakes up beautifully, and it's always a crowd pleaser.
Smoked salmon is actually in the quiche with cream cheese. It sounds like I love, love, love smoked salmon, Stephanie. It sounds kind of heavy, though, that quiche. It's still, I don't know, it's pretty light still?
Well, you have to add, you throw the cherry tomatoes and capers and red onion in there, too. So it kind of lightens it up, but it's definitely rich. You'll want a salad on the side.
Nice. Stephanie, I love it. Smoked salmon, Erin, that is, I love it when that shows up at brunch.
Same. So I love that idea. That sounds absolutely fabulous. I've done a kind of everything bagel breakfast bake. I have that recipe on my website where instead of bread, you dice up everything bagels and then you add, you know, some cream cheese. And I love the idea of putting some smoked salmon in that. That's really fun. I'm going to have to try that in quiche form next.
Sounds fantastic, Stephanie. Thanks for sharing that at 800-642-1234. Gail joins us now in Fish Creek. Gail, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I'm a big partier. I go way back to big parties. And brunch was one of my favorites. So you always have to have that nosh tray out, and I was big with buffet, so that way everybody could have what they wanted and just socialize the whole time, and everything was out on the table and the house was full. But my favorite was to make that casserole that has the bread and the egg in it with all the sausages and the vegetables, and then baking that and then drizzling hollandaise sauce over that for like the center feature of the egg serving for the table, which was great. I had people that wouldn't go home from brunch until 11 o'clock at night. So,
is that still brunch at that point? Yeah.
Yeah, no, they'd order pizza by 8:10 o'clock. I mean, it was like a whole day of party.
All right. Well, let us know when the next one is, Gail. We'll stop by. Thanks a lot for sharing that. So yeah, that bread things you talk about with the sausage, hollandaise, is that a strata or something in that family, Erin?
That sounds like it would be. That sounds absolutely delicious. I mean, who, like, is hollandaise poured on anything going to be bad? I think not. And that just is like, that is just like one of the fun things about brunch. You know, you can be a little decadent, and brunch should be a little decadent. And I think adding that hollandaise sauce is just a really, really fun way to do that.
Thanks a lot for that call. Mentioning buffet reminds me, Erin, you know, I love egg elements in a brunch, you know, the quiche, the deviled eggs or whatever. One thing I'm never a big fan of is like scrambled eggs, because that's one of those things you want like right out of the pan, or an omelet or things like that. Is there a way to do something like that in a buffet or in a brunch that works for everybody? I just steer clear and go with like quiche.
I feel like quiche is the way to go. I mean, we've all had the experience of the styrofoam hotel pan eggs, uh-huh. and that is just not something that any of us want. You know, one idea you could do is to really, if you did a big skillet of eggs, give it a really super soft scramble so that, you know, the carryover cooking doesn't turn it into complete just like hard rubber. But overall, I would probably just stay away from it. If you don't want to commit to a quiche because that sounds like a bit too much, that is where the frittata is fantastic, which is basically a quiche without the crust. You can just find a quiche recipe and not put the crust in it. Like, that actually works really well too. So yeah, it's just for group entertaining, some dishes just work better than others, and scrambled eggs is a great example of that.
It's Food Friday. Erin Clark is with us, helping us with our brunch. Erin has the wellplated.com recipe website, forthcoming book, Well Plated Every Day. Back to your calls. Martha is with us in Milwaukee. Martha, hi.
Hello, good afternoon. I am loving the sound of everything. I have an alliterative brunch favorite. Buckwheat buttermilk Belgian waffles. Ooh. Homemade.
This is waffles. Definitely like a sweet go savory.
Yes, and I like it with plain yogurt with maple syrup and fruit. But yes, you could go either way. Definitely imagine some melted cheese on that.
Ooh, okay. And where did you do, is this something you invented on your own, Martha, or where did you come across as buckwheat Belgian buttermilk pancake?
It is. I do have a recipe for buttermilk Belgian waffles, and I love whole grains and buttermilk. Buckwheat is one of my favorite grains, so I thought I'm going to just make these luscious waffles with that grain, and it made it even richer and more delicious.
Martha, thanks a lot for sharing that. My problem with serving waffles in bulk is, you know, my waffle maker's only so big. You can make only so many at a time. If there's a big crowd, that's one. I don't know. Do you have any advice on mass waffle production?
All I can say is make sure you don't put it on a flat plate. Put it on some kind of grill or, you know, that kind of thing where you might cool cookies, and keep that in the oven at a very low temperature.
Oh, good idea.
And they don't do badly.
All right. Thanks a lot, Martha, for calling in. Hey, Erin, one thing I wanted to get into before we're done is, you know, Easter, a lot of times ham is on the table. Your thoughts on making a great ham, maybe a nice glaze to go with it. What do you do?
I am so thrilled to tell you about my mom's legendary brown sugar ham glaze. It is a family favorite. What she does, and ham, I will just say overall, if you're ever assigned a main dish and you want to do something really easy, ham is your friend because it's already cooked and generally you're just warming it up and adding something to make it delicious. So what we do in my family is we'll mix a couple of different types of jelly together. Like you can do like just apricot, just plum, but my mom will usually kind of dig around in the fridge, see what she has, mix that together with a little bit of brown sugar and some Dijon mustard to give it a little bit of zip and punch. And then you just slather it all over the ham and it forms this like wonderful sticky glaze, and it takes all of like 2 minutes to pull it together.
All right, Erin, that sounds fantastic. Let's wrap it up with beverage, alcohol or non. What are your favorite things to drink at a brunch?
I mean, it's always fun to have a little bubbly at brunch. And something really neat that you can do is just kind of set up like a champagne bar. So you can have a few bottles of Prosecco out, some different fruit juices, and then you just really let guests mix their own. If you want to get really fancy, I have a strawberry champagne recipe on my website where you blend up strawberries to make a puree, kind of same idea as a Bellini, and then you kind of spoon that strawberry puree in. That's really fun. So you can keep it really simple, just orange juice and a couple bottles of Prosecco. You can make it a little bit fancy. And then those who prefer a non-alcoholic option can either just have the juice, or you can provide some club soda that they can mix some of those juices with to make like a spritzer.
Erin, that all sounds fantastic. Thanks again for joining us again.
Oh, it's been wonderful to be here. I have so many new ideas for what to make for brunch now, too.
That's Erin Clark, creator of the recipe website, wellplated.com, author of The Well-Plated Cookbook, Fast Healthy Recipes You'll Want to Eat. Got another book coming out, Well-Plated Every Day. Erin joined us today to help us make better brunches for maybe Easter, Mother's Day, or every day. Still time for you to share your brunch time favorites. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. If you have big brunch plans this weekend, let us know about it. Coming up Monday on The Morning Show, evictions were on pause during the worst days of COVID, but they are back and may be on the rise in Wisconsin. Check out the latest numbers and news on evictions and who is affected most in the state. You could join in with your questions, maybe your own experiences over the last few years. Join that conversation Monday morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network. Today is the Brewers' season opener and away game, and it's Food Friday. Let's put them together. The Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reports on new food options at American Family Field this year. There are lots. Let's key in on a classic, the hot dog. Me, baseball day hot dog, bun, dog, mustard, maybe some sauerkraut, maybe replace the bun with a bigger bun and the hot dog with a brat. At Brewers games this year, from the Journal Sentinel article, they have the Dog of the North, Applekraut, Yellow Mustard, Secret Stadium Sauce, Jalapeno Mayo, Chopped Bacon, and Bavarian Sprinkles. Another one is the Dog Gone Foul, a Chicken Finger, American Cheese, Ranch, Secret Stadium Sauce, Tater Tots and Chives, then the Chili Cheese Dog with Beanless Beef Chili, Cheddar Cheese, Sour Cream, White Onions, and Chives. They're probably all really tasty, right? But for the sloppy eaters of the world, like me, eating these things on a stadium seat or bleachers, half that stuff is going to end up on my lap. Keeping it simple, this is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. A group of editors, literary scholars, critics, and writers got together to make a list of some of the most influential and important American fiction books from the past century. The result is the Great American Novels List, published by The Atlantic a couple few weeks back. It's an expansive list of 136 novels from a wide range of authors and genres, starting in 1925 and ending in 2023. One of the project editors joins us now for a behind-the-scenes look at what went into making this list and to offer some reading recommendations inspired by the project. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What novels from the past century would you put on your list if you made something like this? Did you read any novels in high school or college that have stuck with you? What made them so special? Have you read any new fiction books lately that you think will stand the test of time? American or otherwise, you could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Ellen Cushing is a senior editor at The Atlantic, one of the lead editors of the Great American Novels Project. Ellen, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Great could mean a lot of things to a lot of people. What was great in the context of coming up with this list of 136 novels?
I love this question. I've been getting it a lot.
I bet.
And I should say, like, look, this is, of course, subjective.
Sure.
You could have 100 geniuses make their own version of this list and you get 100 different lists. But for us, what we were looking for was, you know, force of ideas, like novels that had something to say about the world in some way. Beautiful prose, that is obviously very important, unforgettable characters, and we were also really looking for books that did something new or surfaced a new way of thinking about things, like that were sort of significant in addition to being great reads. So if a book hit all of four of those boxes, it was very likely to get on our list.
And somebody might hear this concept and think this is all going to be highfalutin literary fiction. And I think there's some of that here, but there are genres. There's science fiction. There's a Stephen King horror. You were casting a wider net than, say, maybe an academic list of great novels might be.
Yeah, totally. I mean, like, one of the reasons that this project was so fun is that, like, our understanding of literary greatness is so much more capacious than it used to be. Even when I was in high school 20 years ago, there was a pretty set list of books that were considered the canon, and now we understand greatness to take a lot of different forms. So we have a couple graphic novels. We have some children's books. We have a lot of sci-fi. We have a lot of noir mystery type books. You know, these are not exclusively like giant doorstop novels about war and peace written by like white guys. You know, it's a much, and we have some of those, don't sure. worry. But it's a really diverse list in across all different vectors.
I think weirdly, one of the things I like the most is that you came up with 136. You know, a lot of times we go top 100 or a nice round number. You assembled the collection, it sounds like, and then found what number you were at, which I love.
Yes. It drives me crazy when I read a list that's like 100 or 500 or God forbid 1,000, because I'm just desperate to know what the 101st was. And so we just decided, like, look, no one's making us stick to a certain number. Let's just come up with the books that we think should be on this list, and that's the list. So it turned out it was 136.
Talking to Ellen Cushing from The Atlantic about the Great American Novels Project. You could join in at 800-642-1234. American novels from last 100 years. You can join in with your favorites at 800-642-1234. Let's start naming names, Ellen. The oldest on the list, not a huge surprise, I guess, The Great Gatsby by F. Scott Fitzgerald. Can you talk about kicking off this time span with a pretty big name there?
You know, it's a classic for a reason. It's a really, really good book. And, you know, there were a lot of books like this. You know, I would consider also like The Grapes of Wrath, you know, books that a lot of people read in high school or college. And it was really important to us to not just assume that those books deserve to be on the list because we've all been talking about them for so long. So we actually revisited these books. I read the first, I don't know, 60 pages of The Great Gatsby to refresh my memory. And it's a great book with so much to say. So I'm really proud that we have that on the list first. From the same year, we also have An American Tragedy, which is a book that I had not heard of before we put it on the list. And then we have this, you know, like surrealist sort of like very dense, I think it's like 1,000-page Gertrude Stein novel. So it's already like even as far back as 1925. We have a lot of different kinds of books.
And you mentioned The Grapes of Wrath. You wrote the blurb for that one. Steinbeck, John Steinbeck, wrote a couple few novels himself. Why The Grapes of Wrath on the list in particular?
We were really stuck between The Grapes of Wrath and East of Eden. Because they're honestly both really, really, really great American novels. But we decided to go for The Grapes of Wrath mostly because it really innovated in its moment. You know, this was a time when a lot of Steinbeck's contemporaries, like other novelists, were really interested in kind of like glamorous, coastal, beautiful people and their problems. And Steinbeck was interested in writing books about real people in, you know, experiencing the sort of like biggest struggles of his moment. And that was, you know, the climate crisis of the Dust Bowl and westward migration. And he was really interested in human suffering. And that's pretty, it was radical in its moment. And we wanted to recognize that significance.
Now, Ellen, maybe you can help me with some personal advice here. I like to sure. read a lot. I've read some of the books on the list. I haven't read a lot of the books. Somewhere in my reading career, I got allergic to the word should. Like in my head, like, I haven't read that great book. I should read it. And once I start thinking that way, it's like, oh, so now it's a chore. I'm never going to read it. How do I break out of that and read these great books without that? I don't know. Maybe this is just me. I don't know. How do I get out of that should mindset?
I mean, I think that like no one should be in the should mindset. I hear that from people all the time, people that I work with, people that I've met talking about this, you know, so many times over the last couple of weeks talking about this project, I hear people say, and they sort of have this kind of like guilty expression on their face, like, oh, I really should read that, you know? And my answer is like, no, you shouldn't. Only read it if you want to. Like, this is supposed to be for pleasure. Like, we're not in school anymore. No one's making us read these books. You should read this book if it grabs onto you and if you love it. My friend's mom is in a book club where their rule is that you take your age and you subtract it from 100, and that is the number of pages you need to read of a novel before you are allowed to give up on it.
I
love that, because it's true that we shouldn't, no one should be wasting their time on something that doesn't bring them joy. Like, reading is for pleasure. And the older you get, like, the more important it is to just abandon the should. So I guess I didn't really answer your question. I'm not helping you.
Oh, no, that actually helped a lot.
The should. I'm giving you permission to not, don't read a book if you don't love it.
Excellent. I love it. Now, let's move in another direction now. There's a Stephen King book on the list, and I could see some great American fiction list saying, Stephen King, you know, that's popular literature or whatever, not going to touch it. There he is. The Stand is on the list. Can you talk about the inclusion of your Stephen Kings of the world?
I'm so glad you mentioned The Stand, because I had not read it before this project. I have not read all 136 books. I'm coming clean now. I had not read it before this project, but I just started it. And I love it. It is so, so much more interesting, so much more layered than my perception of it. I thought it was Stephen King. It's the Carrie guy. It's going to be scary. It's going to be sort of obvious. It's so rich. It's so layered. It's so complex. It is absolutely a great American novel. Like, it absolutely stands up against all of these other books. And, you know, I think one of the great things about genre is that if you, sort of take the reader out of the world that they live in. You know, we have some books that do not take place on planet Earth because they're sci-fi, or take place in a kind of post-apocalyptic speculative version of Earth. And doing that really puts the reality of life on Earth or in America into sharp relief. Like, I think it's a really genius way to kind of examine this country and its problems and what it's like to be alive from a little bit of a distance. So I think these books absolutely belong on here.
Ellen Cushing is with us, senior editor at The Atlantic. We're talking about The Atlantic's new Great American Novels list. It includes 136 novels published over the last century, including familiar classics, recent favorites, overlooked gems along the way. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234. If you got to pick a couple few slots on the list, what would you put there? Let us know about it. Have we been talking about some of your favorites so far? Is there one that you think gets overlooked, maybe unfairly, for one reason or another? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Ellen Cushing from The Atlantic about what went into making their new Great American Novels list and a great list of suggestions for books we can check out. You can join in at 800-642-1234. I know we've got at least a few readers out there. How do you decide which new or classic book to read next? Do you look at the literary prizes, best of lists, or do you have favorite people in your life that you like to get recommendations from? What would you put on your list of great American novels and why? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Can you talk about some of the diversity on this list? There's a wide variety of perspectives on what it means to experience life in America. Ellen, how did you try to capture that?
You know, we did not go into this project wanting to hit a certain quota, but you'll see as you go through the list of books chronologically, it starts out with a lot of, you know, like white men in their 30s and 40s, and then white American born men in their 30s and 40s. And then it kind of expands in a lot of different ways. So, you know, later on in the list, we have the book, A Brief History of Seven Killings by Marlon James, who's born in Jamaica. Like, we have a lot of people who are sort of similar to this idea that, like, sci-fi or genre helps us see our world in a clearer way. I think that having, you know, immigrant writers who are writing about America with the, you know, fresh perspective of someone who did not grow up here, that's so important. And I think these books, some of those books are so insightful, and, you know, like, it's just so important to see that stuff. And, you know, we looked at diversity in all kinds of different ways. Like, we have books that are really short and really long, and we have books that's absolutely huge, just the sort of idea of what a great American novel should look like. And then we have Watchmen, which is a graphic novel written by a pair of British men who were writing about a sort of alternative version of the US after the Cold War, you know. So like, if you told your grandfather that was going to be on a list of the great American novels, he'd probably be shocked. But as soon as we started talking about it, it just felt right.
Now, you were part of this process. A lot of people were. Was there a book or two that you really went to bat for, or would have if people hadn't put it on the list? What did you really want to see end up there?
So the book that I wish I'd fought harder for, don't laugh, is Gone Girl. I've been thinking about this a lot, and I mentioned it sort of as a joke, and we didn't really revisit it. And the more I thought about it, the more I have thought about it since the list came out, Gone Girl was the first example of a kind of book that has been imitated so much that it's almost hard to see its impact. Like the narrative structure, the big twist, the voice of the narrators, all of these things are things that you see in so many of like the most interesting and most popular books now. But Gone Girl did it first, and then like it did it so well that it was imitated so much so fast that we all kind of forgot that Gillian Flynn did it first. So, and you know, that's a book, speaking of diversity, that like people I think kind of think of as a sort of genre book, or maybe kind of an airport book. It, you know, it was made into a movie, and I don't know that people think of it as a great American novel, but I think it kind of is. I think it has a lot going on.
Yeah, I haven't read it. I read a short story by the author that blew me away for some of the reasons you just said. So that, I will put that on my should
it's
fun
great.
In the fun way list. Awesome.
Oh, you'll have so much fun with it.
Excellent.
It's great.
Let's bring in a caller at 800-642-1234. Jenny is with us in West Allis. Jenny, hi. What did you want to bring up?
Hi. This is amazing. I just wanted to say that what brought me to reading and back to it maybe is going back to like that first book that just said, yeah, you know what? This is super cool. And my book was, oh my gosh. I just lost it.
I think you told our producer it was Harriet the Spy. Yeah. I hope they weren't lying to me.
No, it wasn't. It wasn't that. It was, Oh my gosh. I feel like an idiot right now. No, it was Harriet the Spy and then Charlotte's Web.
Ah, okay. There we got it. Jenny, thanks. I'm glad you thought of it. And Charlotte's Web is one of the three children's books on the list, Ellen.
Yes. Charlotte's Web is very special to us at The Atlantic because E.B. White wrote an essay about a pig that kind of sat in his brain for a little while. And he wrote this essay for The Atlantic, and then he wrote kind of a fiction version that turned out to be Charlotte's Web. So we love E.B. White at The Atlantic. We love Charlotte's Web. I'm so proud that we have it on there. I think it's a very, very rich, layered book that gets at a lot of really big themes, even though it's sort of packaged as a children's book. And Harriet the Spy is an amazing book. I used to, I really wanted to be her for many, many years of my life. We talked about it for this project, and I don't remember exactly why we didn't keep it on, but it's a great pick. It is absolutely one of those books that made me fall in love with reading when I was a little kid.
And thanks again for that call, Jenny. Another one for younger readers, Judy Blume. I mean, in my generation, Judy Blume was huge. You've got Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret. I can see why that one ended up on the list. Talk about that a little bit.
It's a really special book for a lot of reasons. It is one of these. It came out in 1970, and it is still a book that you want your kids to read. You know, my son is 18 months right now, so like his favorite novel is Where Is the Dog? But I hope that eventually, when, you know, in 15 years, I can give him Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret, and it will unlock something inside of him. Like, this is a book about belonging and about family and about growing up and about who you are, and it's about religious faith, and it's about what adulthood really means, and it's about living in a body. There's so much to it, and I'm really proud that we have it on there.
Talking to Ellen Cushing, senior editor at The Atlantic, talking about their Great American Novels Project, 136 books from over the last 100 years. Ellen, what are you hoping people do with this list now? What are you hoping people take away from it?
I'm hoping that people never feel like they don't know what to read again. I think that what I wanted was for people to bookmark this list and return to it whenever they're kind of standing paralyzed in the bookstore and don't know what to get. I know I will be returning to it. I've heard from a lot of people who are trying to read every book on the list. As you have heard, I don't want anyone to feel like this is a homework assignment, but if you want to take that on, that's amazing. Please email me when you finish. I'll buy you a beer or something. I hope that people, look at this list, think about it, think about what greatness means, and find a really great read.
Now, when you put out a list like this, sometimes people take it as fighting words. Are you getting a lot of hopefully good-natured questions like, where is so-and-so an author? Or why'd you pick that book instead of that book by a particular author?
We sure are. And, you know, that's been a joy because it's so nice to hear from other readers and to hear from people who have really, really strong feelings about the books they love. So, you know, I think that people sometimes have felt a little bit sheepish complaining, and that's great. Like, this is subjective. I was never under the impression that, like, we were right and everybody else is wrong. And if you want to come up to me and talk to me about, you know, this is a big one, is Pynchon, Gravity's Rainbow versus Crying of Lot 49. We thought it through. We put Crying on the list. I'm feel very confident in that decision. But if a Gravity's Rainbow super fan wants to talk to me about Gravity's Rainbow and why they love it, like, that's a great conversation for me to have.
And Ellen, you mentioned based on this, you're reading The Stand. You're just a little bit into it. Anything else that came up in this project that instantly shot to the top of your haven't read but want to read list?
Oh, there are so many. I can't decide what I'm going to read after I read The Stand. Just a few that come to mind. There was this book called Family Life by Akhil Sharma from a few years ago that my colleague Gal Beckerman wrote about. It's a book about a pair of brothers, and it seems like it's a book about kind of how you sort of break and then repair a family. It sounds really, really great. There are a couple of books that I haven't read since high school that I would like to reread. So Giovanni's Room, I read, you know, almost 20 years at this point, and I am really, really excited to jump back into it. I feel very, very lucky to have been so close to this, and I'm genuinely overwhelmed about what I'm going to read after The Stand. The Stand is like 1300 pages.
Right. You're
so
set for a while.
Minute. Yeah.
Ellen, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for sharing this with us today.
Thank you.
That's Ellen Cushing, senior editor at The Atlantic. We've been talking about The Atlantic's newly published list of great American novels. Some classics there, surprises, lots of options to add to your stack of books to read. Keep sharing your favorites. Email ideas@WPR.org. Coming up Monday on Central Time, private equity and other companies are getting into the nursing home and senior care business. We'll ask the question, what does it mean when senior facilities are run as for-profit enterprises? That and more coming up Monday here on Central Time.